Dollar, man. This aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shape.
Sergeant at arms, can you please come
on the
in?
Point of order.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Sunday Times Politics Weekly with me, Amil Amra. Thank you so much for tuning in and affording us a little bit of your hard-earned data. Promise it won't go to waste this week, because we've got some sensational topics to talk about. It's been a really crazy week in South Africa's political climate. Now, this week I'm joined in the studio by my colleagues Apiwe de Klerk, Juanita Hunter, and Zingisa Mvumvu. As I've said, it's been a controversial couple of days for politics in South Africa, with a new interim leader elected to our main opposition party, the DA. So, John Steenhuisen, the party's former chief whip in parliament, will take over the reins nationally until the party's big elective conference next year. Steenhuisen was elected over his only contestant, Makhashule Ganna, and won by 75% of the vote. We're also going to be talking about the ANC's perpetual infighting. You remember that old adage about airing your dirty laundry doesn't even apply here. It's like the ANC is standing there naked, spinning their stained briefs all around for people to see. I mean, it's crazy. The newest battleground between those aligned to Ramaphosa and basically everyone else stems from Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan and his announcement of Andre De Ruyter, the outgoing CEO of Nampak, as the new boss at Eskom. Now, it didn't take long for the ANC's Youth League to come out guns blazing, saying it was confirmation of the, and I quote here, deep roots of white privilege in South Africa's boardrooms. Now, the leak said the appointment of De Ruyter could be explained only, and I quote again, in the darker corners of cronyism, which seemed to be perpetuated by the Minister of Public Enterprises, talking about Gordhan here. Then, the Women's League decided to give it a go as well, calling Gordhan's appointment a, and I quote, deliberate entrenched mediocrity in the top echelons of the state-owned enterprises. Quoting them again, the ANC's Women's League is a firm belief that this is a conscious patriarchal agenda to disregard skills and the experience of women, in particular black women, in South Africa. So some strong statements in opposition to Pravin Gordhan's appointment. So let's start with the ANC, guys. The cracks are showing. Does Ramaphosa have control of the ship? Or are these sort of arguments democratic, and should they be had in the ANC? Q, let's start with you.
The thing about these type of appointments is that you really need to entice people to a poison chalice to take over as chief executive of something like Eskom, with the house is burning, right? And so the one part of it is, why would a guy take a salary cut to steer a burning ship, right? So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that, was there nobody else who wanted the job, or no one else was offered the job? That's a very important question for me, right? And then the third thing is that, you know, it's also disingenuous for the ANC Youth League, whatever Youth League you're talking about, because I don't even know a Youth League exists, but, and the Women's League now, to use this appointment to fight a proxy battle, right? Now, when you talk about De Ruyter's appointment, there's criticism from people who are usually supportive of Pravin Gordhan, and rightfully so, right? If you just talk about the transformation element to it, I think that it kind of sends that terrible message that says we need a white man to solve the problems of the day. Because if this appointment fails, Eskom and the economy fails. And that the thing about Eskom is too big to fail is nonsense. It can fail and the economy can go with it. So for me, it's also a little bit disheartening in some way that the conversation can't be, it's so polarizing, the debate, in the sense that, for me, if I look at this guy's track record, your share price dwindled, right?
At Nampak.
Mm. I mean, you're not an engineer. You don't have energy experience. Mm. So for me, if I look at you on paper, you are not the best guy for the job, right? Mm. At the same time, I'm also tempted to say, was this the best choice for transformation, right? But then the craziness about the discussion, it has to be, this guy was appointed by Ramaphosa because he's white.
Yeah.
And I must support that. I want to only criticize that this guy's not the biggest, you know, not the nicest stock they have been. And it's anti-transformative. I don't think we need to be, what is the word? When you just like lose it, what is the word? I think we can have a rational debate to say, you know what, this guy's probably not the best pick, but who else would have taken the job?
Yeah, but there was a whole list of people who had applied. So clearly there were people who were interested in the job. It's not like they just went, they advertised, and of the people that advertised, they didn't cut it. And then they went to issue an advert again, and then no one applied, and then they went to headhunt.
But you do know these advertising processes are complete farce, right? When it comes to SOEs,
that's my biggest problem. But that's where I want to go with my argument. That, well, if and the point you are making is valid, and I think that's the point that the Women's League and the ANC Youth League task team, whatever they are, should be emphasizing on more. That what was the motivation? I get the fact that the guy was at Sasol. Sasol, well, you speak energy and you're not a stranger per se to the energy sector. But he was not the CEO, isn't it?
Yeah, he was very junior, actually. I heard a guy yesterday explaining, like, he was reporting. There were five people above him in terms of the reporting line.
Yes, so, but aside from that, I mean, what's the motivation? And also a pay cut. I never, ever trust someone who moves from business or in business in an executive position and takes a pay cut. For me, my suspicions, it's always two. It's either you are running away from something where you are, or where you are going, you are going to get more than just what you are being paid. It's never rational. I would never take a pay cut as a journalist now. I mean, to go and work for a newspaper, a community newspaper somewhere. The only other reason would be, well, I would hold some sort of power in some small town where I would get more than just being a journalist or maybe an editor of that newspaper. I would never. It doesn't make sense for anyone. I would like to understand it. I would also like to understand the rationale behind choosing the guy. I mean, maybe the minister will, when going to the portfolio committee in parliament, maybe break it down. Why was he the preferred candidate at this juncture? I mean, for Eskom, I mean, I thought you needed a star. A star performer, someone who can say, no, he turned around this company. This company was in the brink of collapse, and then he came through and turned it around. Its share price was not point what, and now it's at 15 rand. It's at 24.
Or even if the share, even if the share price dwindled, as in the case of Nampak, to explain to say, okay, this was the industry norms. This was this is other companies who were in that space. You know, this is how we're suffering. We were supposed to bleed so much more, and I start, you know, that kind of take. But that means you have to respect the public, and if you don't respect the public, why must you give an explanation?
I'll take it up on Chu's last point of the public. First of all, my take on this situation, the untransparency in which these appointments are made, you know, it shocks me. Public companies like Eskom, they are our interest, all of us, especially those of us who pay tax. In fact, we all pay tax in one form or the other. So we have a direct interest as shareholders. We are the shareholders of Eskom. We ought to know the criterion and the process that was followed to appoint someone into such a position. And perhaps in the future, what ought to be done is to conduct these interviews and the process in an open manner, such as is the case with the public protector, for instance. You know,
good luck with that one. Eh?
Yeah,
we couldn't get it with SARS.
No, I was just going to say, yeah.
And SARS is not even a company; it's part of government.
But yeah, so this is exactly what I'm saying. And you see now this culture of these appointments happening behind closed doors and being suspicious about this one being connected to that one and that one, it just polarizes the whole debate, because we would be able to debate properly had we saw this process, had we had public interviews to say, but this guy even fumbled in the interview, why did he get this job? Secondly, again, a point that I've observed with this appointment, I think the ANC so-called deployment committee is completely dysfunctional. I don't even think it exists. You know, for ANC structures to be at each other's throats in this manner, it goes to show that within the ANC as the governing party, there was no discussion in this regard in terms of the kind of person that ought to be done. They talk about their so-called National Democratic Revolution. I don't even know what it means, you know, and the objectives thereof, one of which being to transform, South Africa, especially at an executive level of management in the corporate space. So, again, that is just another point that the ANC is clutching at straws. They don't know whether they are coming or going. They've just left it to God's hands, Shem. You know? You know? So those are the pointers, Amil. It's unfortunate that the debate is around race instead of being around the guy's, track record and experience. I think the debate should be on merit. As you had put it, and Apiwe, I think on merit, with what we know now, is that the guy didn't deserve the job.
So does the conversation about race muddy the discussion around competence?
Absolutely, yeah, I think so.
And I think this was going to be my next point. And when you're talking transformation, I'm not just talking about a black face or a black person. I'm talking about, because the Women's League raised the point about women and having 50% of women as CEOs of SOEs. Eskom, if we talk about transformation and we talk about that position to be precise, I mean, they have been giving black executives a chance. Not to say when you're saying black executives are failing, therefore they must be replaced by white people to show them how to do it. No. It's to say, because we have a history like this, it doesn't matter no more. Because that's the whole point of transformation. You create a culture whereby it's equal opportunity in that sect, insofar as it has to do with Eskom, that anyone who is capable then can do it, because you've shown that we have a culture that gives black people an equal opportunity when they are competing with their white counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
So Eskom has done that, has shown it. And a lot of these people who are anti-transformation have been criticizing Eskom to say it's because of the transformation agenda that Eskom is failing, which is a lie. But Eskom, if you look at it, look at its organogram, look at the demographics and whatnot, you cannot not say it is untransformed in terms of our organogram. You can argue when you talk about who it does business with, who it buys coal from, and so forth. You can argue about that, and you have a valid argument. I think that argument about transformation, insofar it has to do with Eskom specifically, it's misplaced.
Yeah,
you can make an argument for a woman CEO. That you can do.
Why?
How many female CEOs Eskom has?
The bigger problem up here with parachuting a woman, and I say this with the most amount of cautiousness and wearing my feminist flag very high and proudly. The problem I have with the Women's League saying 50% of SOEs must be run by women. The reality of it is that if you look at that same Eskom organogram, you're not going to find women on that board, enough women on the board. You're not going to find women in the second tier of leadership, the third tier of leadership. You know where you're going to find women? Right there at the bottom. Your engineering pool, how many of them are women? Not much. So the problem with saying, no, we need a woman on the top, is to that same fake is that fake transformation.
Absolutely.
Of just, it's that kind of the opposite, the female equivalent of blackface, you know, you just know, you know, we need to solve a problem. What the Women's League needs to encourage or to pick up a fight with Gordhan to say, okay, you appointed a male, we're unhappy that you appointed a male CEO, but give us the organigram and tell us how many women do you have in your executive beyond the chief executive officer, and how are you creating programs? Because remember, to grow in Eskom, most of Eskom comes from Eskom. So you grow, you know, and you up the corporate ladder. So how are you making it easy for women engineers? How are you making it easy for inspectors of Eskom, for, you know, all of these things? Because the reality of it is, I can't think of one woman who's been authoritative voice from Eskom in any capacity.
Look, there is this debate a lot of people have been having, is also to criticize the appointment, to say, but the guy is not even an engineer, you need an engineer. But, you know, companies have shown that to be a CEO, you don't necessarily need to. The CEO, is our CEO a journalist?
No, but the difference. But the difference is, in the absence of you drop the share price of Nampak. You are a white guy. Da 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 da. So you must at least have some. You, maybe your one selling point must be you have knowledge of the industry, and you don't.
Yeah.
So what I was saying is, there's nothing that was stopping them from going to the corporate world and seeking a female who is capable as a CEO. So that was the point I was making. You could have just put Maria Ramos there as well.
Whoa, I mean, you see, Abhi,
she's capable. She has shown. I mean, if you can take her to PIC and have her.
Now you're going there.
No, but you're messing up. Also,
but what I'm saying is that if Women's League are arguing for women, it's not like there are no capable women who can turn companies around.
But
and that the fact that the argument of being an engineer cannot be used against this guy, then it cannot be used against women who are not experienced engineers in the field, which is, they didn't necessarily have to come from Eskom up. It could be other women who have been doing well.
But can we agree on the superficial... Side?
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that one. I agree.
Actually, that is the point I wanted to add on that. This, any so-called transformation that is top-down approach, it will never work. Because as you put it, what is the point of having that person at the top when the rest of the organization is untransformed gender-wise and race-wise? You know, so... The transformation debate needs to be deep and not be myopic and very narrow in the manner in which the ANC Women's League are approaching it. And they've been doing this even in terms of government deployments, with the fighting for MECs to be. I don't agree with that kind of approach, because you can have an MEC who's a female if the rest of the department in terms of the organogram is 80% male and 20% women. It doesn't help. It's just it's an elitist kind of approach that I completely disagree with, you know. So ANC Women's League needs to do better. I don't agree with their argument on this, in this regard, at all. I don't agree with the ANC Women's Youth League task team. Theirs, I think it's a proxy fight. We know the people in charge, most of them are aligned to the RET faction. So it's a factional fight of the ANC. They are not even interested in the issues that they are talking about. And it shows by how they completely miss the point that they, you know, they just go for the man, go than this. They don't go for the issues that pertains to this appointment. So the whole thing is just a farce as far as I'm concerned. People who are contributing within it are missing the point completely.
And the other thing is, Zingi says that there is a bigger issue here. And I hate to be that person that would be like, oh, there's a bigger issue than race. But there is a bigger issue in the sense that Eskom needs to be unbundled, right?
Yes.
And even within the ruling party, there is an agreement on it. Labour is completely against it. The unbundling of Eskom is linked to the lifeline Eskom gets or doesn't get. So the reality of it is that this man is coming in to a task that nobody even agrees is the right thing to fix it.
Yes.
And so you have this really precarious situation. You have a board that's a bit dodgy.
Yeah, no, that long and big rubber stamp.
You know?
Hey, when are they firing that one?
I don't endorse that message. Jabu Babuza, if you're listening.
Me too. By the way, on Saturday, I have a head that looks like yours, so I don't endorse.
But the reality of it is that, you know, it makes me sad that this announcement was supposed to be how are we going to fix ESCOM,
yes,
becomes fodder for political infighting.
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, let's take a quick short break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about another racial issue, but this time in the DA. Join us when we're back.
Racial identity politics, a phrase that has the potential to start an argument in just about any situation. That's why we're starting it first. Let's Start an Argument is a unique and insightful podcast series about the meaning of race to us today. Presented by researcher Cecilia Koch and Doctor of Philosophy Jason Werbeloff, the series aims to spark rational argument and meaningful discussion around this controversial topic. Find Let's Start an Argument now on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, welcome back. Now, in a climate where race-based politics seems to be at the top of the agenda for the DA, we have John Steenhuisen taking over control of the party, if only temporarily. Now, but more importantly, his election with a 75% majority of voting delegates shows that it's almost likely that he will become the next permanent leader of the party next year. Now, Apiwe, what does this say about the way in which the DA is going, the election of John Steenhuisen in such prominent position, or the most prominent position?
First of all, my brother, before you go to Apiwe, remember last week, I was the one who congratulated
you did call
him
it.
In advance.
You did
yes.
call it.
Yeah, and people said, yeah. All right.
No.
So you must first congratulate me.
Congratulations. You should have put some money on it.
We congratulate you, Vovo. You see the difference between you and I on this particular one? Is that even though I agreed with you off air, I couldn't say that. Chief, I'm still going to write the story. So, I mean, imagine Ghana hearing the podcast and then I'm calling him and he's like, but why do you want a comment from me? Because you already said I've lost. But you see, like what I was saying last week, it was a good thing that John Steenhuisen won with the landslide. It means at least the people that he's going to be leading with at federal council, they've given him a full mandate.
Unlike Ramaphosa at Nazareth.
Oh, God, you went
there. Yeah, I mean, correct.
So it's going to be less. It means for me, a lot of people are going to rally around him.
Yeah.
They're going to support him, but then the battle begins. This was just, a process to have a face for the party. Mm. But then the real battle begins now, going towards their policy conference in April. Because you must look at how this battle was being fought. It was fought around the policy positions. John Steenhuisen going this way about not running away from mentioning race, using race as a proxy, and so on. In fact, he made a comment that I couldn't understand. And the journalists at that press conference were not holding back on the issue of race. And then they asked him about the job stats that were talking about how much white South Africans are being paid more than black South Africans, which were released by States SA. And then, astonishingly, he said, we are reading the stats wrong. In fact, the stats are not calling for race-based policies. They are showing that race-based policies have failed. But this thing is talking about salary disparities.
Of course.
And then I couldn't understand where he's coming from, because you saying here, we started from 94. And it was a norm that black and white South Africans doing the same jobs, men and women doing the same jobs, that the men must earn more, the white person must earn more. So they implemented employment equity. There was BE, but employment equity being the more appropriate for salary, this thing of salaries. And he says race-based policies have failed. That there are salary disparities. It shows that it's because race-based policies have failed. I couldn't get his point because if you then track from 94. Or after employment equity was implemented to now, you would see that even though there's still a gap, it has dropped.
Of course.
So I couldn't understand him. But anyway.
Yeah, well, look. Well, once again, congratulations to Johnston Hayes.
told you so.
Yeah, no, it was always going to happen this way. I mean, you know, actually, with your point there about Nazareth, it's good that he got this overwhelming mandate. It means that whatever program that he wants to, you know, pursue in his position as the party leader in the interim, is going to be largely successful. You know, it's one thing whether you agree with it or you don't. And you are pretty much correct, unlike the current president of the ANC and the country, Cyril Ramaphosa. Part of the reason there's so much mess in the ANC and the country is because of that tight, you know, victory that he managed at Nazareth. It's never good, you know. So, you know, in as far as his politics are concerned, I think the guy is largely confused, especially on this issue of race politics. You know, I've been listening to him, as Apiwe is saying, he just makes a whole lot of comments that don't make sense. I can't even begin, I don't even know where to begin from that press conference and all the other interviews he's been doing on radio. Actually, someone tweeted yesterday that every time Steyn Huisen opens his mouth on this race issue, some thousands of votes are running away from the DA, because I think even the core constituency of the DA, they're beginning to be confused about the kind of message that this guy is trying to communicate. I think he ought to, you know, take a back seat and reflect and decide what sort of coherent message is he going to punt going forward. And
but
I
you can't do that when you're a populist.
That's what I'm saying. You see, and I think that is part of his problem. That's what he is, you know, currently battling with. He wants to please everyone. He doesn't want to sound too offensive. Too
Why does it sound so familiar as well?
You are on a roll, Amir. You are on a roll.
Yeah. So you see, I mean, that's really the problem. Mm-hmm. And people who cannot have a backbone and take a stand, whether if you believe in something, I believe you should be able to coherently articulate it and be able to defend it against those that disagree with you, and then be able to be willing to be convinced and to convince people. And I don't think Johnston Hayes is that kind of a person. And there's another issue of him that I think he's struggling with: emotional intelligence. The guy blocks everyone on Twitter who disagrees with him. I don't think that's the kind of leader, you know, that will be able to take the heat that comes with being a leader of the official opposition in the country, because there is going to be a lot of views that are slamming the DA, its policies and its direction, as we are doing now. We are criticizing it. Tomorrow, I'm already blocked. I would have been blocked.
Are you blocked up by Siri?
Yeah. So you see, also, I think he needs to work.
I'm the only one that's not blocked by Siri.
He's not blocked. Amir only.
Me.
Oh, you're not?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even bother him on Twitter. I'm sorry.
Okay, let me just tweet it that. Say, hi,
unblock me and then listen to our podcast. I'm saying nice things about him.
Wait, yes.
Me too, Kater. So you see, that's another issue. I mean, so really, the guy has got a lot to work on personally as a political leader, because as a political leader you ought to have a thick skin. You ought to take, I mean, for instance, not that I favor him, let me just make an example with Julius Malema. Julius Malema is one political leader who takes a whole lot of flack on social media, although he's got quite a, you know, huge you know, support base in that particular platform. But even those that criticize him, I've never saw him to be a person who takes criticism in bad light to the point of blocking you. He engages, disagrees, enforces, and unleashes his army, his defense army on you. You know, but that's the kind of nature, a political figure ought to be, not one that is a crybaby, that has got a light skin, blocking people left, right, and center. What is he going to do about people within his party who disagree with him? Are you going to expel them?
And that pettiness is very Helen Zeller-ish.
Yeah,
in many ways.
But Helen Zeller does not block people. Helen Zeller has written a whole thing responding to a story I wrote about a debate in legislature, but she never blocked me.
Well, I mean, the point that I'm making is that John Steenhuisen is a little bit, I don't want to use the word juvenile, but like, you know?
Yeah, he's a crybaby.
Yeah, very immature. No. Very immature in some ways. And even in the way I've noticed the way he's been interviewed is that you have an understanding as a politician and as a journalist, when you sit down with a journalist, that it is my job to scrutinize you.
Mm.
Those journalists that were sitting in that room at that press conference with you, Apiwe, it was your job. You get paid. You get on the 25th, you're going to get a salary for doing that job. And it's his job to present himself. So it's not personal.
Yeah.
Now, when you start interpreting things as personal and personal attacks, you realize, and politicians in the past have shown, who have taken these things personally, have realized, you know, the consequence of it is that you don't live long as a politician, because you are constantly concerned about what other people are saying to you, and you can't grow a thick skin. Yesterday I had an interesting discussion with Advocate Hermione Cronier, who's the head of the NPA's investigative directorate. And we were just laughing. They had a media roundtable. And I said to her, you know, it's so funny, because I did a story some weeks ago, I don't know if you guys remember, about them appointing 4 senior counsel, right? And honestly, when I was writing the story, myself as the author of the story, I was like, it sounds a little bit like good news, like we're being too PR-ish, you know, because and I know the editor even said, like, you know, South Africa needs some good news, give that story, and they put it at the bottom of the front page, right? And subsequent to that, there was a lot of outrage because there's no females in those 4 senior councils.
Yeah.
And she's like, she was so perturbed and upset and, you know, all of these things, because she's like, I'm a female. I'm at the heading of the institute. The NDPP is a female. And why is this an issue? We got the best top, you know. And then she says, yeah, but then I had to realize I need to get a thick skin. Mm. And I was like, that stuck in my brain. Just like, people in high office need to get thick skin.
Absolutely. No, we really...
Because someone's not going to like something you do.
Emotional intelligence, for me, Q, is one of the most, if not the most critical value that a leader of any kind, be corporate, public, political, church, even pastors, they need to have that thick skin. You can't be a leader and be immune to criticism and fear being criticized and fear being disagreed with. Hence, I'm saying Mr. John Steenhuisen has got a lot to work on. Even the jokes about his highest qualification being matric, really, he needs to grow up. This joke has been made for months and months, but he still takes, you know, offense from the question, which is reality, by the way, you know.
So let's round it off like this. I want to ask you this. What is the DA, do you think? How is the DA, and what is the DA going to look like under John Steenhuisen? Are we going to see any massive changes from what we've seen under Musi Maimane? Where's the DA going with John Steenhuisen's leadership?
I really can't answer that question with confidence, Amil. It's just the first week.
Yeah.
It's just the first week the guy is in charge. He came through being supported by the number of people that have brought back Helen Zille.
Mm.
I saw he was telling some media organization that he's nobody's proxy.
Mm.
You must understand that whatever it is that happened with Musi, they worked closely together. Mm. Yes, he criticized the direction of the party now, post Musi's era, but surely there were a lot of things that he agreed with that leadership. So I don't know how much of changes he's going to make. Let's give him maybe a week or two and see, because You know, the other thing is that it's an interim leader. So he's there are people who, I can tell you for a fact, are saying, no. We had been approached to contest, but we didn't want to contest because what killed Moose is that we didn't have policy clarity.
Yeah.
So anyone could just stand up in a meeting and say, I know, you see. So now that there is a policy conference that is coming.
Yes.
So that's why I'm saying the real battle starts now, because it's going to be a real battle of ideas, and it's going to be crucial for him to ensure that his ideas about what the DA ought to do, how it ought to look like, its stance on race, and he wins that. If he doesn't win that, go after a policy conference, anyone then who's challenging, you know, they want to see where is the party going, because a lot of talk is there about people saying, no, the party is going back to what it was. No, it's abandoning this thing of having one South Africa for all others. Because Musi says it's no longer the vehicle. You know, if your leader, as he's resigning, saying this project that we thought that we're doing is no longer viable here. So people are waiting on the sidelines to see, okay, this debate, this discussion, what is it going to yield? And therefore, then people are going to be coming out of the woodworks to challenge for leadership, because everything will be in offer at the conference post that. So he is going to be very careful not to piss off a lot of people, but I think he's going to push very hard, especially because he's got the support he got from Federal Council, which was very important for him, because when he's then driving his ideas, even though he's not the one who's going to be leading the policy discussion itself in terms of the logistics of it and all of that, he's going to want to to ensure that he cements his position, but without pissing off a lot of people. Yeah. So it might be that you won't really necessarily see what the true DA would be under Steyn Huisen until he's re-elected after Congress. But let's wait and see.
Let me tell you my frank opinion.
Oh, another prediction coming this
no,
way.
No. my frank opinion is that, first of all, it's John Steyn Huisen, in my opinion, is the proxy of Helen Zille, and he is going to implement what Helen Zille wants. We saw it with Musi Maimane, and we said it at the time that Musi Maimane was Helen Zille's proxy. And at the beginning, he was, you know, dancing to that tune until he found his own voice. But so determined was Helen Zille after Musi became his own man to remove him, that she came back from political wilderness. And I think John Steyn Huisen will learn from that lesson. We cannot run away from the fact that his election to that position is directly linked to the election of Helen Zille as the Federal Council Chairperson. And Helen Zille being the most powerful politician in the DA right now, in fact, for the past 15 years, in my opinion, I think this one, John Steyn Huisen is going to implement what are the views and, you know, what is liked by Helen Zille. And because he will understand that his safety and his, if he is about to return at the actual conference next year, then that's what he ought to do.
Oh, unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you guys so much for joining me in studio, and thank you for everyone out there who's listening. We'll catch you at the same time next week. Have a good one.